Look, after the choir, I feel like the leftovers. You guys have been full. I feel like the turkey dinner after Thanksgiving that nobody wants to eat. Okay, look, you've seen the sermon message. So you know this is not a Sunday school text I'm about to read. It's not even a lectionary text because they don't want to deal with it. We have these texts in the Bible that sometimes startle us. That one verse where it says that God tried to kill Moses, and we're like, oh gosh, let's just quickly read over that. As if to say, sometimes when God calls us into ministry, look out, things might get tough. There's that text where Abraham is sitting there arguing with God over the plight of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he's sitting there and he's going back and forth with God as if to say, God, what kind of God are you? Then there's that text none of us really like, that text where Abraham's about to sacrifice his son, and then God says, whoa, wait a minute, what kind of God do you think I am? This is one of those texts. Hear now the word of God. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and settled near a certain Adullamite whose name was Hiram. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He married her and he went to her. She conceived and bore a son and he named him Er. Again she conceived and bore a son whom she named Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she named him Shelah. She was in Shezeb when she bore him. So Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. And then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law and raise up offspring for your brother. But since Onan knew the offspring would not be his, he spilled his semen on the ground wherever he went, whenever he went into his brother's wife, so that he would not give offspring for his brother. What he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he too was put to death. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up, for he feared that he too would die like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah's time of mourning was over, he went up to Timnah to the sheep shears, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. When Tamar was told, hey, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear the sheep, she put off her widow's garment, put on a veil, wrapped herself up, and sat down at the entrance of Idiom, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He went over to her on the roadside, and he said, come, let me come to you, for he did not know it was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me? He answered, I'll send you a kid from the flock. She said, only if you give me a pledge until you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet ring and your cord and the staff that's in your hand. So he gave them to her. He went to her. And she conceived by him. Then she got up, went away. Taking off the veil, she put back on the garments of her widowhood. When Judah sent the kid by his friend the Adullamite to recover the pledge from the woman, he could not find her anywhere. He asked the people, where was the temple prostitute who was at Enium by the wayside? But they said, no prostitute's been here. So he returned to Judah and he said, I've not found her anywhere. Moreover, the people said, no prostitute's been there. Judah replied, well, then let her keep the things as her own, otherwise we'll be laughed at. For you see, I sent this kid and you could not find her. About 3 months later, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law Tamar is pregnant. And Judah said, "Bring her in. Let her be burned." As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, "It was the owner of these who made me pregnant." And she said, "Please take note. Whose are these? The signet ring, the cord, and the staff." Then Judah acknowledged them, and he said, "She's more in the right than I." And he did not lie with her again. When the time of her delivery came, there were born twins in her womb. While she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and bound it on his hand a crimson thread, saying, "This one came out first." But just then he drew back his hand, and out came his brother. Therefore he was named Perez. The other was named Zerah. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Some time ago, Max Dupree was a big name, especially in the corporate leadership world. He was known for giving lectures and tours and talks on leadership all around the country, and was touted as somewhat as a guru on the subject. And he tells in one of his books about being in a hotel in Phoenix one time when his left knee gave out and he was unable to walk for some period of time, so he had to be placed in a wheelchair and be rolled around by his wife, Esther. At this particular time, they were in Phoenix. He was about to give a lecture, and he was being wheeled about, and they had eaten meals several times, many times before, in this particular hotel where they stayed when they were there. And each time the hostess had looked at him in the eye and said politely, "How many, sir?" But this particular morning, as he was sitting in his wheelchair, she looked right past him. She spoke to Esther, "How many, please?" She led them to the table, and again, as they were about to sit down to eat, she looked right over him and she says, "Your server will be right with you." Max sat there, this giant on leadership and corporate leadership, this guru who likes to give talks and is known for lectures. He sat there, and this woman didn't even notice. "She didn't mean it," he said. "But in the twinkling of an eye, that well-meaning young woman had stripped me of my identity and purpose and position. It was as if I didn't matter or even exist. I was absolutely ignored." Which made him realize, in what he wrote in his book, he said, "To be oppressed is wrong, but to be overlooked may even be worse." It's a feeling nobody likes. It's a feeling nobody wants. I recall many years ago in the elementary school that inevitable game of kickball where you would be on the field and the teacher would say, "Okay, line up, we're going to choose teams." And whether or not I was the captain that day or whether or not I wasn't, I hated that moment. Especially when I was the captain, because somebody was going to be picked last. Nobody likes to feel overlooked or unwanted. I remember talking to a friend of mine. It's been a while now, but she was getting ready. She was adopted, and she was getting ready to try to find her birth mother. And I asked her, I said, "Well, what if you do? What are you going to say?" She said, "I'm not mad. I've had a great life. My mom and dad have been terrific. But I would like to know why." Nobody likes to be overlooked or felt unwanted. As we enter into the scripture this morning, we find ourselves in the midst of another story concerning the family of Jacob. That story takes up quite a bit of Genesis. The last half is specifically about Joseph. But in the middle of the Joseph story, we get chapter 38. This little interlude about Judah. It's a story about another one of Jacob's boys, the oldest, Judah. It's a story that begins with a woman. And at first glance, the narrator seems uninterested in her, as if she's just some casual bystander to the real story that's going on about the men in the story. After all, it's the men who are important. They have all the real power, all the real say, all the know-how. And so Tamar is just kind of there, but she's really not there. Nobody seems to be interested in her at all. It's about Judah and his sons, and about the decisions that they are making. Tamar is the outsider. She's a woman. She has no voice. She has no say. She has no power. Judah comes along and he chooses her, lucky her, to be the wife of his oldest son, Er. We don't know much about him other than his actions were thought to be so evil that they blamed his death on God because they had no other explanation. God must have just not liked him. But he's dead. He's gone. He's left behind a new wife and no child. No offspring to inherit the family blessing. And that puts Tamar in a very vulnerable position, and very much at the mercy of Judah's family. See, at that time, for the protection of just these type moments, there was this thing called the Levirate marriage. It's spelled out for us in Deuteronomy 25, and if you ever can't sleep at night, I invite you just to go read that. It'll knock you right out. But in case you don't, what it really is this. When the husband dies and the wife has no children, the closest male heir is supposed to step up and resume the responsibility of producing a male heir for the family. Because it was inconceivable that a widow should inherit the husband's property or inheritance. She's to provide a male heir. So no one in this story lingers to mourn much over the plight of poor Tamar. Nobody bothers to think about what she might be thinking about all of this, how she might be feeling. Her husband's dead. Judah just sends in next in line, Onan, get in there. You're up, buddy. Give it your best shot. And Onan, he's a sneaky man. He knows, in short, that if he goes in there and he does the job he's supposed to do, he's not going to get any of the inheritance. So he doesn't. And then he's dead. So now we have Tamar, widowed twice over. No children. After two funerals, Judah sees her as just bad luck on the family. Out of sight, out of mind. Go back to your daddy's house. Just get away. And when Sheila grows up, I'll call for you and you can come back. And he wanted her out of the way, out of sight, out of mind. But here's the thing. It's not like she can just move on with her life. She's stuck. She can't remarry because in truth she's betrothed to the youngest. So years pass. She's stuck. Committed in a relationship where she is unloved. Unwanted. Overlooked. Childless. Desperate. So one day she hatches this very unorthodox plan. She decides to do something that's very risky. It's dangerous. Her life is in danger. She puts herself out there. And she goes and she takes off and removes the widow's clothes and she sprays on a little drop or two of Chanel number 5. And she heads to town and she waits for Judah to come walking by. Well, I've read the text. You know what happens. 3 months later, Judah hears the gossip that his daughter-in-law is pregnant, and boy, he is fit to be tied. He is in a tizzy. She's been out there embarrassing the family name. Get her up here so I can, knock some sense into her. How dare her? And so they do. They bring her up and they bring her in, and she's about to be burned when she says, I have something to say. I've been quiet too long. It's true, I did all those things. But the child's father is the owner of these. Now tell me, Judah, do you recognize these? And she throws a big ring at him with a big J on it. And his face just turned white. Everybody's yelling, burn her, burn her. And he turns and he says, y'all go home. Y'all go home. She's more in the right than I am. That's an amazing thing for him to say. Judah, the one who sold his brother into slavery. Judah, the one who discarded this young woman. It's an amazing thing for him to say. Because it was him. He was the one who was supposed to provide for her. He was the one who was supposed to take care of her. And it was her. Now, this story may be a little R-rated for some good church folks like us. But dang if I don't admire her determination. And her desire not to be overlooked anymore. So here's my question, folks. Why is this story in the Bible? This racy, provocative, full of sex and lies and scandal and deception. Why would we even worry about a story like this? I dare say we probably wouldn't. I wouldn't give it a second thought, probably, if it wasn't for Matthew. You recall how Matthew starts out his gospel, his good news of Jesus Christ? He starts with a genealogy. And in that genealogy, it says, this is the story of Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, the father of Jacob, who was the father of Judah, who with Tamar conceived twins, Perez and Zerah. That's how he starts his good news. Bringing up in the family tree of Jesus the story of Tamar. Why would he do that? Of all the women in the family tree of Jesus, why would this harlot by the side of the road make the list? Why would Matthew want us to remember her? I don't know for sure, but I think it might have something to do with who Jesus is. You remember that time in Matthew that he tells us that woman came up to Jesus and she was an outsider. She was a Canaanite woman and her daughter was ill. And the disciples say, oh, for the love of Pete, send her home. She's aggravating the tar out of us. She's not one of us. Get rid of her. And Jesus says, let her come talk to me. She knows she's out on a limb. And she says, Master, even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table, and I just want a crumb. And Jesus says, disciples, come here. Let me show you something. You see her? You see her faith? My God, how great is her faith? Just like that, he acted as if she was important just as anybody else. You remember the time he was trying to teach the children and they were all up in his beard and picking his nose and, you know, pulling at his beard, and the disciple said, get rid of the children. You're trying to do something important here, Jesus. And he said, let the little children come to me. As if to say, they're just as important as anybody else. That was Jesus' biggest problem. You know that? The problem with Jesus. The problem with Jesus is he thought that everybody should be treated the same. That in the eyes of God, everybody is the same. About a year ago, I had a friend, colleague, and we had this tradition for a while. She's since moved on, but we had a tradition where we would meet about once a month and have lunch on days off and get caught up and just, you know, gossip about the church. And this particular day, I met with her, and she was just as giddy and bubbly as all get out. And she says, "Oh, I have had the best weekend ever." I said, "Well, why?" She said, "Well, we had a wedding yesterday afternoon in the church, and I got to perform it." And I said, "Well, that's good. That's great." She said, "It was absolutely beautiful." And I said, "Well, most weddings are, you know." She said, "Oh, the sanctuary was covered in flowers and decorations, and the bride's dress was just lovely. It was beautiful, and she looked stunning and amazing, and the sanctuary was packed with people. It was a big crowd." I said, "Well, that is wonderful. That put me in a good mood." She said, "Well, it didn't start off that way." She said, "At first, the bride and groom, they didn't show up. It was supposed to start about 2 o'clock, and they didn't get there till 5. I said, "What in the world?" See, what you have to understand about this particular wedding was that the couple who were getting married was a homeless couple. It was a homeless wedding. And she had agreed to do it because she had gotten in touch with them through a ministry that she was involved in. And all the flowers and the decorations in the sanctuary were provided by the church. The ladies' group had gone out and bought her a dress. It wasn't a fancy dress, but for her it was the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen. The day of the wedding, the sanctuary was full. Homeless friends, church folk, college students. Bride and groom were nowhere to be found. Well, we can't have a wedding without them. So she went to where she thought they might be, and sure enough, there they were. And she said, "Are y'all getting married today or not?" "I don't think we're coming." "Well, why?" She said, "We're not worthy of that kind of love. That's just too much." They finally got them to the church about 5 o'clock. And I sat there and I was told the wedding was beautiful. See, if it weren't for Jesus, we might could get away with overlooking people. But the biggest problem he had with Jesus was that in the eyes of God, we're all the same. You could be standing behind the podium in front of the largest room about to give a lecture on leadership, or you could be wheelchair bound and have to be rolled into church. In the eyes of God, you are exactly. You can be a Canaanite woman fighting to be seen, fighting to be heard. Or a homeless couple humbled by the attention given to them by strangers. In the eyes of God, exactly the same. What in the world? What in the world are we supposed to do with a God like that?